You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is Lecture 5, given in Dornach on March 25th, 1920. In the course of these lectures, as we draw ever closer to that special field where pathology is meant to pervade therapy, bridging the gap between the two, we will have to mention all sorts of topics that can serve only as therapeutic ideals and cannot necessarily be fully implemented. Nevertheless, if we have an overview of what should be considered in treating patients, the details we discover about an illness will yield something of use to us, and at least we will know how to evaluate the inevitably fragmentary conclusions. Above all, we need to examine the importance of understanding the whole person before us, even when treating the most specialized case. Also, this understanding of the human being as a whole should always include the most important events of the patient's life. Members of the medical professions sometimes confide in me and discuss some aspect of a case. After listening to a few words, I have often asked how old the patient was and been astonished to find that the medical professional was unaware of the patient's age and unable to give me any precise information. As we will see in the next few days, it is most important to inform yourself about the patient's age with some degree of accuracy, because therapy is dependent on the age of the patient to a great extent. The day before yesterday, certain therapies were presented as having been extremely helpful in some cases, but not in others. In view of such statements, the very obvious question is, what is the connection between this inefficacy and the age of the patient in question? It is essential to record all the details with regard to how the age of the patient influences the working of therapeutic substances. Moving on, it is essential to observe carefully how your patient's body has developed. Is this person short and compact, or tall and lanky? The answer is significant, because it tells us about the forces of that person's etheric body, as we call it. I have given this a great deal of thought and have concluded that the use of such terms as etheric body and so forth, which are simply part and parcel of the reality of the human being, is unavoidable, and you would probably not want me to avoid them. We could substitute ones that are more popular among non-anthroposophists, and we may be able to do this at the end of our discussion, but for now, for the sake of better understanding, we will continue to use such terms when necessary. The intensity of the working of the etheric body, then, can be assessed on the basis of your patient's growth patterns. As I said, it is not always possible to take everything into account, because the information may simply be unavailable. But it is good to know about all this. Whenever possible, it is especially important to inquire about whether the person in question grew quickly or slowly during adolescence. Did he or she remain small for a long time, or have a growth spurt at a relatively early age and lag behind later? All of these questions point to what we might call the behavior of the etheric body, the functional manifestations of the individual in relation to the physical body, which must be taken into account when we hope to recognize a connection between the patient and particular remedies. In addition, We must also understand the relationship of the physical and etheric bodies to the higher members of the human constitution, to what we call the astral body, the soul element, and the capital I, the spiritual element. We need to learn this from our patients. And you should not hesitate to ask, for example, whether they dream a lot or only a little. Frequent dreaming is extremely significant for a patient's entire constitution, because it shows that the astral body and the eye have a tendency to develop activity of their own, and therefore do not want to become involved with the physical body too strongly or in too much detail. As a result, the formative forces of the human soul do not flow into that person's organ systems. Furthermore, even if you are uncomfortable in asking this question, you should also inquire whether the person is active and hardworking or tends to be sluggish. In a personality with a sluggish tendency, the inner mobility of the astral body and the eye is strong. This may sound paradoxical, but this type of mobility does not become conscious. It remains unconscious. And because it is unconscious, the person is not hardworking, even with regard to consciousness, but is sluggish overall. This is because what I call the opposite of sluggishness is the individual's organic capacity for using the higher members to intervene in the lower human being. That is, for leading activity over into the physical and etheric bodies from the astral body and the eye. This capacity is very limited in a sluggish person. From the perspective of spiritual science, a sluggish person is a sleeping person. After that, you should find out whether your patient is nearsighted or farsighted. A nearsighted person is somewhat reserved with regard to how the eye and astral body relate to the physical body. Nearsightedness is one of the most important signs that you are dealing with a person whose spirit and soul are reluctant to intervene in the physical body. This next indication is extremely important in treating patients and may become practicable someday. I believe it could acquire practical significance once the individual medical professions have developed a better sense of cooperation. It is extremely important for dentists to take advantage of everything they know about the teeth, the digestive system, and so on, by providing each patient with some sort of checklist after each visit, noting their findings with regard to the development of the patient's teeth. Whether there was an early tendency to dental caries, whether the teeth remained in good condition until a later age, and the like. As we will see in the next few days, the condition of the teeth is extremely significant for assessing a person's overall constitution. Making this characteristic signature of the patient's state of health available to the attending physician in the form of a report of dental findings could provide a very significant clue. Of course, the patients in question would have to give their consent, but in an atmosphere of cooperation, this should be possible. Next, it is extremely important to become aware of the patient's physical likes and dislikes. You would have to find out, for example, what foods the person in question craves. It is especially significant to determine whether the person you are treating has a craving for salt, for example, or for something else. If your patient has a particular craving for salty foods, you are dealing with a person with an overly strong connection of the eye and the astral body to the physical and etheric bodies. In this person, the spirit and soul have an overly strong affinity for the physical body. Dizzy spells, brought on by outer mechanical processes, such as rapid turning motions, are also indicative of a strong affinity of this sort. We should ascertain whether mechanical body movements tend to make the patient dizzy. Additionally, as is fairly generally known, we should always find out about any disturbances in secretion, in the patient's overall glandular functioning. When disturbances in secretion are evident, a disturbance is also always present in the ability of the eye and astral body to maintain their grip on the etheric and physical bodies. I have given you some details about what we would need to know when we meet a patient. I have highlighted details, but you will see where these subjects are pointing insofar as they relate to the constitution of the body itself. As we continue, we will also discuss the need to learn about lifestyle issues, whether or not it is possible for the patient to breathe good air, and so forth. We can consider this further when we discuss individual issues. In this way, you will first gain an insight of sorts into the type of person you have to treat. Only when you have acquired such insight will you be in a position, in any specific instance, to know how a particular remedy should be formulated. Next, I will mention in general terms an indication that has emerged from some of the lectures of the past few days, namely, the inner relationship of the human being to the entire non-human outer world. Spiritual science often states, although abstractly to begin with, that in the course of evolution, humankind has discharged the other kingdoms from within itself, and that everything external to human beings, therefore, bears a certain relationship to their own nature and constitution. In contrast to this abstract manifestation of the connection, we will repeatedly have to point to very specific associations when it comes to the treatment of organs. Above all, however, the basis of the healing relationship between the human being and non-human external nature must first be clear to us. You know that there is a great deal of debate on this subject, and that methods of healing, which we will also discuss in greater detail as we proceed, are engaged in fierce struggles with each other. One struggle in particular is well known: the struggle between physicians who favor homeopathy and those who think allopathically. It might interest you to know that how spiritual science is meant to intervene in this quarrel. For today, I will first speak in general terms about this topic, and go into the details later. The way in which spiritual science should intervene in this question is actually rather strange. It becomes apparent to spiritual science that there really are no allopaths, because even a substance prescribed as an allopathic medication undergoes a process of potentization within the organism, and healing occurs only through this process. Thus, all allopathic physicians find their procedures supported by the body's homeopathic tendency, which brings about a transformation allopaths neglect, namely, breaking down the cohesion of the remedy's individual particles. Admittedly, it does make a considerable difference whether or not we relieve the organism of this potentization process, for the simple reason that healing processes within the organism are probably connected to the state remedies gradually achieved through potentization. Initially, however, a remedy confronts the body as a foreign entity, as matter that would otherwise belong to the outer world and has no therapeutic relationship to the body. We subject the organism to a great deal of work and disruption if we burden it with all the forces that come to expression when we administer a medication in the allopathic state. We will speak later specifically about cases where it is impossible to relieve the body of this potentizing function. Homeopathy is a method of healing that has been learned by listening very carefully to nature, at least to some extent, although fanaticism has also brought about significant leaps, as we shall see. The important point, however, is to discover ways of relating specific details about the human being to the non-human environment. We cannot, as I said yesterday, in a different context, simply parrot the physicians of antiquity, although it can be useful to immerse ourselves in ancient medical literature if we understand it. Instead, for example, we must use all the methods of modern science to explore this interaction between the human being and the non-human environment. First of all, we must realize that chemical investigations of substances, that is, delving into what individual substances reveal in the laboratory, will not get us very far. I have already pointed out that microscopy, and such chemical investigations are also a form of microscopy, ought to be replaced with macroscopic observation, with what is revealed by observing the cosmos itself. Today, I will present significant principles that will point out correspondences between a form of threefolding in the non-human world and the threefold human being. In this connection, we must look first at the dissolving process. You see, solubility was the last property that was of special importance in the evolution of our planet Earth. What precipitated out as the Earth's solid portion can be traced back to a considerable extent to a cosmic dissolving process that was overcome and killed off, precipitating the solid parts. It is superficial to think only of the mechanical deposition of sediments and to base geognosy and geology entirely on that process. Geognosy, G-E-O-G-N-O-S-Y, footnote, is the study of the earth, its structure and strata, and includes geology, which includes the earth's crust. Geognosy, end of footnote. What was primarily involved in the earth-forming process, in incorporating solid components into the body of the earth, consisted of special instances of crystallizing or precipitating out of solution. We can say that to the extent the dissolving process is something that happens in outer non-human nature, it is something that human beings have excluded from themselves. External dissolving processes involve activities that human beings have excluded from themselves. The important point here is to investigate the nature of the connection between these processes in the external non-human cosmos and inner processes in the human organism. I mentioned earlier that people tend to crave salt when the connection between the spirit and soul and the physical and etheric bodies is overly strong. This is of fundamental importance. These people want to reverse the process of salt precipitation in their own organism. That is, they want to cancel out this earth-forming process, essentially making salt revert to an earlier stage, before its solidification in Earth's evolution. It is especially important to look at such phenomena because they allow us to investigate the connections between the human organism and outer non-human nature, to realize that there is an organic need in the nature of the human being to reverse or oppose certain activities that take place in the outer world. As you know, I mentioned yesterday that we even struggle against gravity through the development of the buoyancy that supports the human brain. In general, human beings have a tendency to oppose the forces of nature. The first question is, what is the meaning of our opposition to the earth-forming process? Essentially, it means nothing less than freeing the lower part of the human being from the spirit and soul, driving the soul and spirit out of the lower region of the human body, perhaps into the upper part, at least initially. All cases of salt craving show us that in some way the lower part of the human being wants to free itself of the overly strong effects of the spirit and soul within it, and to allow them to flow out into the upper part of the body. Let us assume that we encounter recognizable disturbances in the lower part of the body. We will later learn about the means of recognizing them and the individual diseases they lead to. But what will we be able to do about them? At this point, I would like to interject an observation that may be important for those tending toward a certain one-sidedness in their use of therapeutic substances. Some physicians have an aversion of sorts to mineral remedies. This aversion is not justified, because we will see that pure phytotherapeutic substances can be effective only within very definite limits, and that mineral remedies are very significant, especially in more serious cases. Please do not be offended if I take mineral remedies as my point of departure for these very basic observations. More specifically, I will talk about how the effects of these mineral remedies are incorporated into organic life. Studying the oyster may be a revelation to you with regard to certain methods of treatment that apply to the lower parts of the human body in their relationship to the upper areas. Shell formation in the oyster is an extremely interesting subject because, you see, the oyster produces its calcium carbonate shell from the inside out. If you study the oyster from a spiritual scientific perspective, and it is indeed necessary for spiritual science to assist us somewhat in this investigation, you will realize that although the oyster occupies a very low position in the evolution of animals, its standing in the cosmos as a whole is quite elevated, because it secretes what human beings carry within them in the form of thinking. In a certain way, the forces that shape the oyster shell, working from the inside out, show how the oyster extrudes a substance that would make it very intelligent if it were linked to its organic growth, a substance that would shape the oyster into a very highly evolved animal being. Instead, this factor is channeled to the outside. You can positively see the work of calcium carbonate, Calceria carbonica, in the development of an oyster shell. This work guides excessive activity of spirit and soul out of the organism. If you find evidence of excessive activity of soul and spirit in the lower part of the body, and this does indeed appear in certain forms of illness that we will describe further, you will need to turn to the remedies we owe to oyster shells or similar substances that work from the inside out through the mysterious forces of calcium carbonate. Thus, an essential component of our therapeutic repertoire will depend on our understanding of the specific healing forces present in this outward-directed impulse. You see, everything that is linked to Calceria carbonica and related remedies can be studied rationally only by looking at it in such a context. The inherent forces of phosphorus, for example, are like the polar opposite of the forces of calcium carbonate. In their real meaning, the terms I will now use are truly no less scientific than what so frequently passes as science today. If the typical behavior of everything of a salt-like nature is to give itself up to the environment, the reason is that everything salt-like comes about because the substances in question are laid bare, freed from the workings of light and other intangibles within them. You might say that in the process of coming about, any salt-like substance repels the intangible factor as being inwardly incompatible with it. The exact opposite is the case with phosphorus. Ancient atavistic knowledge, realizing quite correctly that phosphorus contains the intangible factor, the light, within itself, was not wholly unjustified in describing phosphorus as a light-bearer. What salt wards off, phosphorus carries within itself. In this way, substances that are the polar opposites of salt are the ones that are appropriate and internalize intangibles, especially light, but also others, such as warmth. This is the basis of the therapeutic efficacy of the inherent properties of phosphorus and of everything that is therapeutically related to it. Phosphorus, which internalizes intangibles, is especially suited to pushing the astral body and the eye back into the human body when they are reluctant to approach. Suppose one of your patients has an illness. Later we will mention the specific illnesses that come into question. And you discover that this patient experiences increased dreaming. This means that the astral body prefers to separate from the physical body and become involved in activity of its own. This patient may also have an organic tendency to develop peripheral inflammations, which is another indication that the astral body and the eye are not properly embedded in the physical body. In this case, you will be able to apply the force that phosphorus uses to retain its intangibles to make the person's astral body and eye become more involved in the physical body. You will be able to use phosphorus for a great variety of illnesses, especially in people with sleep disturbances, because it tends to lead the eye and the astral body back into the physical and etheric bodies in the appropriate way. We have seen that in a certain way, phosphorus-like substances and salt-like substances are polar opposites. Let me emphasize that we need to pay much more attention to the status of these substances in the entire cosmic process than to specific names that modern chemistry, for example, has applied to individual substances. As time goes on, we will see how the phosphorus, in quotes, in substances that work in ways similar to actual phosphorus, can also be used therapeutically. As you see, we have posited the existence of two opposing states in outer nature, salt activity and phosphorus activity. Mercurial activity stands between these two. As you know, the human being is a threefold being with a sensory nervous system, a circulatory system, and a metabolic system, with the circulatory system occupying a mediating position between the metabolism and sensory nervous activity. Similarly, in outer nature, the mediating factor is neither salt activity, which yields to the external world, nor the activity that internalizes intangibles strongly, but rather the factor that holds the balance between these two activities by choosing to exist in drop form. Basically, the mercurial principle always tends toward drop formation because of the inner cohesiveness of its forces. The significant aspect of the mercurial principle is not the fact that we call a certain substance, quote, mercury, close quote, but rather this cohesion of forces, which holds the balance between the dissolving tendency of salt and the inwardness and retention of intangibles in phosphorus. It is therefore important to study the forces that are most evident in anything of a mercurial nature. Thus you will also find that this mercurial principle is essentially connected to everything that can be counted upon to bring about a balance between the activities to which phosphorus and salt are suited. Especially when we talk about syphilis and similar diseases, we will see that the organic effects of the mercurial principle do not contradict what I have just said. In discussing the phosphorus, mercury, and salt principles, I have presented you with types that are particularly distinctive in the mineral kingdom. It is true, however, that in speaking of salt, we had to consider the organic process that is intrinsic to and underlies the formation of oyster shell. In a certain sense, this process is also present when phosphorus concentrates intangibles. In the latter case, the process is internalized and is therefore less readily apparent on the outside. We must now move on from looking at this typical formative process in the outer world to the plant-like element that humankind discharged at some time in the past. As we already saw yesterday from other perspectives, the plant represents the opposite of the activity present within the human organism. In the plant itself, however, we can clearly distinguish three different elements. This triple distinction is especially obvious if you look on the one hand at everything that develops earthward in the form of roots, and then at everything that shoots upward into seeds, fruits, and flowers. The contrast between the plant and the human being, although not between the plant and the animal in this case, is visible even in their external alignment. This contrast is extremely important and significant. The plant sinks into the earth with its roots and pushes upward with its flowers, that is, with its reproductive organs. With regard to our own orientation in the cosmos, we, human beings, are the exact opposite. In complete contrast to plants, we root upward with our heads and push downward with our reproductive organs. It really is not nonsense to picture a plant within the human being, a plant that roots upward and develops its blossom below, in the direction of the reproductive organs. In this way, a particular form of the plant element is incorporated into the human being. Once again, this is an important characteristic for distinguishing between human beings and animals. In an animal, the plant is generally incorporated horizontally, at a right angle to the plant's own direction, while the human being's orientation in the cosmos constitutes a complete 180-degree turn in comparison to the plant. This is one of the most instructive lessons we can learn by considering the relationship of the human being to the external world. If our medical students would pay more attention to these macroscopic findings, they would also discover more about the forces at work in cells, for example, than they would through microscopy. There is actually very little to be gained from microscopy, because the most important forces that are at work in cells can also be observed on the macroscopic level, with variations depending on whether the being in question is a plant, an animal, or a human. We can study human cells much better by investigating the interactions among the forces that work vertically upward, those that work vertically downward, and those that hold the balance horizontally. These forces, which can be observed in the macrocosm, work right down into the cellular level. And what is active in cells is essentially nothing other than a copy of this macrocosmic activity. In studying the Earth's plant kingdom, it is critical to avoid looking at it in the usual manner, that is, by walking around and looking at one plant next to the other, observing the subtle distinctions between them, and inventing a name with two or three parts to establish each plant's place in taxonomy. Instead, you must consider the entire Earth as a single being, and the whole plant kingdom as belonging to the organism of the Earth, in the same way that the hairs on your head belong to your own organism, although admittedly your individual hairs are all alike, at least in some respects, while plants differ from each other, An individual plant should no more be considered in isolation than a single hair can be considered an independent organism. That plants differ is due only to the fact that the Earth, in its interaction with the rest of the cosmos, develops forces in many different directions. For this reason, plants are structured in different ways, but the life and growth of all plants are based on a single unity within the organization of the Earth. This makes it especially important to be attentive to certain details. When you study fungi, for example, you will find that the Earth itself is a matrix, or growth medium, for these fungi. When you move on to higher herbaceous plants, you will find that this is still the case, but that supra-earthly factors, such as light, exert a certain influence on these leafy plants in the formation of their flowers, leaves, and so on. And when you turn your attention to a tree, it is especially interesting to note that its trunk formation, which is what makes it perennial, constitutes a continuation of what the entire Earth otherwise provides for plants that sit directly on the ground. You see, you must imagine that you have the Earth with the plants sprouting up out of it, and in this case we can look for forces within the Earth that underlay plant growth and interact with what is streaming in from the cosmos. Please, don't be too shocked by what I am going to say next, because it really is true. When a tree grows, it is as if the ground rises up over what used to flow directly from the earth into the tree. This force shoots into the trunk, and all trunks are basically outgrowths of the earth. That we do not look at it like this is simply due to the truly distorted modern materialistic view that the earth consists only of mineral matter. This view totally fails to acknowledge the impossibility of the idea of a mineral earth. In addition to precipitating minerals, the earth also contains forces that shoot upward into the plant kingdom. These are the forces that rise up to become the trunk. And what then grows out of the trunk is comparable to what grows directly out of the ground in the case of lower and herbaceous plant forms. I would say that the earth itself is the trunk or stem of lower and herbaceous plants, and that the plants whose flowers and seed capsules cling to a stem have created an extra stem for themselves. As you can see, it makes a difference whether I take a flower from a tree or from an herbaceous plant. From this same perspective, then, please consider the development of parasitic plants, especially mistletoe. In this case, a process that otherwise remains organically connected to the plant, namely the attachment of flowering and seed-bearing organs to the stem, is more like an outer excretion or an independent process. The development of mistletoe must be seen as enhancing the usual formation of flowers and seed, and separating this process in a certain way from the forces of the earth. In the development of mistletoe, the plant's non-earthly aspect is emancipated, so to speak. In general, the aspect of the plant that strives upward from the earth and interacts with supra-earthly factors gradually separates from the earth as flowers and seeds form. In mistletoe, this results in an exceptionally strongly individualized emancipation. If you relate this phenomenon to the usual structures you perceive in plants, you will have to say that the situation is considerably different from that of a plant that tends more toward root formation, devoting a greater proportion of its growth primarily to its roots, while its flowers remain small or atrophied. Such plants are more inclined toward earthly factors. In contrast, plants that emancipate themselves from these earthly factors are ones that emphasize the formation of seeds and flowers, and especially those that assume the role of parasites within the plant kingdom. Every plant has a tendency to promote one of its organs to prominence. Just look at how the pineapple plant emphasizes its stem, for example. Or take any other plant. You can say that each of the main plant organs, root, stem, leaf, flower, fruit, becomes the primary organ in some form of plant. Take a plant such as Equisetum, for example. All of its efforts are subsumed in stem formation. Other plants emphasize leaf development, while still others concentrate on flower growth and allow their stems and leaves to atrophy. As it turns out, there is a certain parallel between these different tendencies in plant growth and the three types of mineral activity in non-human nature that I mentioned earlier today. If we look at what appears particularly strongly in the plant that tends to emancipate itself, that is, at the process that culminates in the inner workings of parasites, we find a tendency to internalize intangibles. If the appropriate organs predominate in the plant, the intangible factors that stream toward the earth from the cosmos are conserved in them, just as they are in phosphoric substances. We could also say that in a certain way flowers, seeds, and everything that tends in the direction of mistletoe and the like are phosphoric. Conversely, if we study the rooting process that a plant develops, if it considers the earth its matrix, we find that it is intimately related to the formation of salts. In this way, we encounter these two polar opposites in the plant kingdom. And in the mediating activity in plants, which is always present between the flowering and fruiting element that pushes upward and the rooting element that holds fast down below, you have the mercurial process that brings about a balance. If you take into account the reversal of the plant in the human being, you will realize that any inner predisposition to flower and fruit formation must relate very strongly to organs that are either located in or governed by the lower human body, and that the same is true of phosphoric substances. In the next few days, we will see that this view is absolutely correct, In contrast, any plant part that strives to become root-like will have a particular relationship to all the organs of the upper body. Of course, you must keep in mind that we cannot simply divide the human being into three parts according to an external plan. For example, the digestive system, which belongs to the lowest region, certainly attempts to continue right up into the head. It is erroneous to think that the gray matter of the brain is providing the material basis for thinking, because this is not the case. Gray matter is essentially there to nourish the brain. It is actually an outpost of the digestive system that serves to nourish the brain, while the brain's white matter is what is significant as the material basis of thinking. This is why you will find an aspect of the anatomical constitution of gray matter that has far more extensive connections to one of the body's overall activities than to the function ordinarily ascribed to it. So you see, when we speak of digestion, we cannot refer exclusively to the abdomen or the lower part of the body. And it is certainly true that when we look at the root-like element, we find that it relates not only to the upper part of a human being, but also to the rest of the body. Everything in the plant that brings about the balance between the flowering and fruiting element and the root element, that is, everything that comes to expression in the leafy parts of ordinary herbaceous plants, will prove to be especially important, even in extract form, for everything that relates to circulatory disturbances, that is, for the rhythmical balance between the upper and lower areas of the body. Earlier in this lecture, we looked at the minerals that internalize intangibles, the minerals that ward off intangibles, and the intermediate types. As you can see now, we find parallels in the overall configuration of the plant. Here, you have the very first rational means of establishing an interaction between the human organism and the plant itself, based on the emphasis the plant places on developing one or the other of its organs. Later on, we will consider specialized manifestations of this interaction. Up to this point, we have been able to point out that such interrelationships exist between plants or minerals and the human being. Recently, something very promising has been added to the picture with regard to the interrelationship that is supposed to exist between humans and animals. However, even disregarding the fact that the development of animal serotherapy took place under rather strained circumstances, principled objections must be raised to the usual form of this therapy. You see, Behring actually proceeded in a very strange way while developing serotherapy. That is S-E-R-O-T-H-E-R-A-P-Y. I'm going to read it as serotherapy. Footnote: Emil Adolf von Behring, 1854 to 1917, a German bacteriologist at the Koch Institute of Hygiene and at the Institute for Infectious Diseases in Berlin, professor at the University of Halle, and later director of the Institute of Hygiene in Marburg. See the extensive note at the end of this lecture. End of footnote. If you follow the speeches that were given and the publications that appeared more peripherally, which discussed only what the serum was meant to help, you are given the impression that serotherapy has the potential to reform the entire medical system. However, if you carefully examine the basic studies, an astonishing fact is revealed. And this is not an exaggeration, as one or another of you will probably recognize. The researchers were attempting to develop a treatment by studying guinea pigs, so that they could then apply it to human beings. It yielded a, quote, strangely high, close quote, percentage of unfavorable results in guinea pigs, In fact, out of the large number of guinea pigs treated with the serum, the result was favorable in only one case. In one single guinea pig, thus masking its healing process, at the very moment when people were beginning to drum up support for serotherapy in a big way. I would simply like to present this as a fact, of which I believe some of you are already aware. The extraordinary sloppiness evidenced in this incident deserves to be considered more carefully in the context of the history of science. But there is a principle that I want to introduce to conclude today's lecture, and that I will elaborate upon tomorrow, or at some time during the next few days. Today you have seen that the natural outer processes that directly affect the human being are not those that exist on the immediate surface. Instead, they must be brought up from the depths. In a certain sense, processes that human beings have eliminated from within themselves, the processes of phosphorus and salt, and the plants flowering, fruiting, rooting, and leaf forming, are closely related to the human being, but in such a way that the human being lives in their inverse and has an innate tendency to negate anything expressed in non-human nature, turning it into its opposite. The same is not true of animals. They have already gone halfway through this process, so human beings are not the opposite of animals in the same sense. Humans stand at a right angle to animals, as it were, but are removed 180 degrees from plants. This must certainly be considered when raising the issue of using animal remedies, such as serums or the like. That's the end of the lecture, but there is a note on the critiques of Emil Adolf von Behring that I will include. Quote, "On the development of diphtheria immunity and tetanus immunity in animals," from the German Medical Weekly, number 4, December 4th, 1890, an article on Behring in Kitasato begins with the words, quote, "In our long-term studies of diphtheria, Behring, and tetanus, Kitasato, we have also drawn closer to the issues of therapy and immunization, and in infectious disease, we have been able to both cure infected animals and pre-treat healthy ones in such a way that they no longer contracted diphtheria or tetanus after treatment." There's a footnote here, Chibasaburo Kitasato, 1852-1931, Japanese bacteriologist who studied under Robert Koch, 1843-1910 in Berlin. He isolated the bacilli of tetanus, symptomatic anthrax, and dysentery, and prepared a diphtheria antitoxin. He also discovered the etiological agent of bubonic plague. End of footnote. Quote, "The way in which immunization and cure are effected will be discussed here only to the extent that this is needed in order to prove the following statement correct. Details will follow in the magazine titled Hygiene." Close quote. The remainder of this article speaks only of experiments with tetanus. In the same weekly, number 50, Behring describes attempts to bring about immunity to diphtheria. He says of the treatment, quote, "I must emphasize that I have no remedy for diphtheria in human beings. I am merely looking for one." Close quote. This must be contrasted with the sentence from the first article quoted previously. At the end of the second article, he tells us that serum injections have been successful in treating animals with tetanus. The essay concludes, quote, "The possibility of curing even illnesses that take an acute form can thus no longer be questioned." Close quote. The promised article in Hygiene finally appeared in 1892. No prior article has been discovered. It documents two series of experiments involving a total of 60 animals, 59 of whom were either immunized or given the serum at the same time as, or days before, being infected with diphtheria. The procedure used on humans, parenthesis infection on day 1, 1 day of illness on day 2, serum injection on day 3, close parentheses, was copied in the case of only one animal, which was cured. In the other, quote, cured, close quote, animals, either the illness had not yet developed, parenthesis series 2 experiments, December 1891 to January 1892, close parenthesis, or, in most cases where the serum was injected before infection, death resulted, parenthesis series 1 experiments, September through December 1891, close parenthesis. From a volume of critical essays on the question of diphtheria serum, parenthesis, quote, physicians speak out about and against Behring and his therapeutic serum, Dr. Karl Gerster, editor, A. Zimmer's Verlag, 1895, close parenthesis, it appears that such publicity was not well received in medical circles at that time. The final end of lecture 5 of this cycle.